Investigative journalist Jeff White has covered technology for BBC News, Channel 4, Audible, Forbes, Online, and many others. And we talk today about his new book, Crime.com, which has just been published and is his book on cybercrime. Delighted to welcome you to the show. Morning, Jeff.
Hi, how you doing?
Very good. Wow, what a subject this one is, and one that's not going away anytime soon, is it, this cybercrime?
Not at all. No. I did worry when I was writing this. I said to my wife, you know, computer hacking, is that, you know, is it still a sort of thing? And she said, when was that film Hackers released? And I said, I think it's about 1985. And she went, no, I don't think it's going away any. It's and of course, coronavirus has given the whole new set of wheels. So yeah, it's not going anywhere.
It has. It goes back, I guess, to the kind of high tech community in the US, particularly on the West Coast, the kind of hippie tech community, didn't it?
Yeah. There's this really fascinating sort of backstory. So a bunch of those hippies who tried to sort of create a sort of communal utopia, you know, in the real world, and that had obviously not gone too well. You had the Altamont concert riots. And, you know, there's a sense that it wasn't going to work. So a bunch of them started working online and saying, well, there's this new thing, cyberspace. Maybe we can create a communal hippie experiment in cyberspace. And, of course, the idea of that is it's away from governments and it's away from laws and regulations. And, yes, that's very good for people who are countercultural. It's also quite good for people who are interested in crime.
I'm just trying to think back to the kind of 70s. That must have been very primitive equipment. It must have been those old kind of dial-up modems and stuff they were using.
It was even worse than that. There was this bizarre device where you would take the handset, the phone handset, was on a big spirally cable with an earpiece and a mouthpiece. You'd stick that in two like rubber cups And then you would use the software to sort of dial in. And there was this thing called the bulletin board system, BBS, which was, it sounds like you remember this.
Oh, I do. I was a member of many bulletin boards.
Oh, my gosh. This was like Facebook back in the day. It really goes back. But what's interesting is, you know, that's where a lot of the sort of early hacking culture emerged, you know, this idea of, and again, at that point, hacking, you know, could be benign or it could be malicious, but it's mostly benign. There wasn't a lot of money to be made, but it's where that sort of culture emerged from. A really fascinating time.
Yeah, and I guess then, in terms of the people who were being hacked, there was very little protection because it wasn't a thing, was it then?
Yeah. I mean, some of the earliest viruses were the most lethal because, as you say, there wasn't any security in place. But what was interesting is a lot of those viruses were sort of cheeky. They were kind of, you know, games, you know, to screw up people's computing. But the vibe behind a lot of those early viruses was, look, you aren't secure. You can get a virus. It is possible. So let's try and sort of think about this and work on this. Of course, you know, they weren't making any money, those early viruses. In fact, one of the first big computer viruses called the Morris Worm, so-called because the guy behind it was called Morris. His surname was Morris. Okay. What then emerged was his dad worked for the U.S. government on cybersecurity. And so the gossip was that this virus was created and released to show the US government, look, viruses are possible.
Wow.
And there was some interaction between father and son, purely speculative, of course.
And you mentioned the film of the time there, and what was brilliant about those kind of hacker films of the time was that it was always like a teenage kid that saved the world, wasn't it? They'd talk to the kid and he'd be in this room full of computers and he suddenly got tapped furiously on the computer and then 2 minutes later he'd have hacked whatever they needed and saved the world.
Exactly. And that, actually, do you know what? That still happens. So there was an attack in 2017, the WannaCry ransomware attack, which people may remember, hit the NHS disproportionately, caused a whole bunch of havoc there. There was a chap, so this virus was going nuts. It was spreading around the world. It was an auto-spreading virus, which made it extremely dangerous. So lots of people were looking into this. A young chap called Marcus Hutchins was working in Devon at the time. And he's, you know, he was a bedroom techie. He had all his kit in his bedroom and stuff. And he looked into this virus and he found the off switch, which everybody else admits. So he managed to bring the virus to a crashing halt. But there was a fascinating postscript to Marcus's story. So he attended as a big hacker conference in the US and he flew over to the US to attend that conference and was then subsequently arrested by US authorities and has now been convicted because it turned out that years before his involvement saving the world from WannaCry, Marcus had invented some bank hacking software called Kronos. And so he has now been convicted in the US.
Oh, dear.
very sorry for what he did, but yeah, your past catches up with you.
Absolutely. Is it fair to say that if hacking was born in the US with the hippie tech community, it kind of grew up in the Eastern Bloc?
I think it is fair to say that. Look, this hacking happens all around the world, and this criminal hacking happens all around the world. You know, UK, France, Germany, Brazil's big hacking scene in South America. But the fall of the Berlin Wall really, and the collapse of the Soviet Union really gave a massive sort of boost, because at the time there was already sort of organized crime going on in Russia. There was already a massive amount of credit card fraud going on. And what was interesting was in 1995. The big browser, the big web browser, was Netscape. If you want to get online, use Netscape. Yeah, and so Netscape introduced this thing where you could use credit cards on websites, which was basically a huge boom. So eBay and Amazon both get launched the next year, because like, wow, credit cards are usable. The problem with that is, yes, you can use them safely on the internet, but the companies that receive the credit card details and hold them don't necessarily hold them securely. So Russian hackers start breaking in, nicking credit cards, and then defrauding and raiding those credit cards for as much money as possible. And it is a really sad story. I mean, you know, there were some brilliant minds coming out of Russian universities. They sent hundreds of thousands of kids to university to learn engineering and electronics. And when these kids came out into the sort of havoc of the, you know, post-Soviet Union Russia, where are they going to get a job? So some of them, you know, turned to cybercrime, and that really gave the push, I think, to that early industry.
It did move, though, from kind of lone hackers to state-sponsored hackers, really, as well, didn't it?
Absolutely. And what was interesting was that period I talked about where credit card fraud was rife in Russia. Out of the sort of carnage of that emerged an amazing, fascinating guy called Evgeny Bogachev, who, if you look up his name, he's still on the FBI's Cyber Most Wanted list. And he was sort of the Steve Jobs of the cybercrime industry, was right. Evgeny. He didn't invent a lot of stuff, but he just refined it and made it really easy to use, which is obviously what Steve Jobs did at Apple. And when they raided Bogachev's network, they've never arrested Bogachev. He's still apparently free and at liberty. When they raided his network, what they found was he and his buddies weren't just hacking into banks and stealing credit cards and doing all that sort of stuff. They started to find on his systems top secret and confidential sensitive documents that were of use to the Russian government. And so the assumption on the part of the researchers was that Bogachev was then working in concert with or on behalf of or for the Russian government, because these documents weren't credit card numbers, they were government type documents. And so from then on, you get this coming together of organized cybercrime and government hackers. And that's really been the story ever since.
When we go back to the year 2000, we were all panicking, weren't we, about the Y2K bug, which of course never happened. But ironically, there was a much bigger bug which came out of a computer in the Philippines, the love bug, which paralyzed lots of businesses, didn't it?
Yes, yeah, 45 million computers around the world is the estimate on that. So this was, as you say, yeah, Y2K. I was around for that. I was working for an internet company at that time, and we all breathed a big sigh of relief when we came in after New Year and our computers were still up and running. And then May of that year, a virus starts spreading. And again, like the WannaCry ransomware thing that hit the NHS disproportionately, this was a worm virus. And the problem with that is there is no off switch. You can't stop this thing. So it was an email that would arrive on people's computers. There was an attachment that said that it was a love letter. And the idea was, you know, this is a secret admirer sending you a love letter. So people would click to open it. It would infect their computer and scramble their files. It would send copies of their password away, but it would also spread itself to everybody in their Outlook contact book.
Yeah.
And if you think of that, the math is really interesting. So imagine you're the first victim of that. If you send that virus to 50 other people automatically without knowing it, and they send it automatically without knowing it to 50 other people, it only takes 6 hops to infect every computer in the world.
Goodness me.
Because you think 50 times 50 times, but you do the math on a calculator, the numbers get real big, real quick. So what companies started doing was, because this thing was spreading, and even if you didn't get infected, it would clog up your email. Companies started disconnecting their computers from the internet, their email computers, to stop getting clogged up, which when you think about it, is a bit like what we've done with coronavirus. You know, even if you're not infected, you stay indoors, you disconnect yourself from society. And that economically can be as ruinous as getting infected. So,
how extraordinary. The hackers are clever people, and it often puzzles me why they do it, what their kind of motivation is. I've interviewed a few of them and they say, well, it's just like climbing a mountain because it's there, basically, and they just want to have a go at it. Are there many hackers that kind of we never hear about who would, for example, hack into, let's say, a bank system? And of course, that would be terrible for the bank, for anybody to find that out. Are they kind of gently pushed off into a corner and offered a job?
Well, yeah, there's been efforts in the industry to try and, you know, divert youngsters away. So in the UK, the National Crime Agency try and do outreach programs and try and get to these guys. And actually, if the NCA find out about a low-level offender, there are instances in which they go to the house and just have a chat and say, look, the next time we come, it's going to be with a warrant. You know, you don't want that. But what they also do is say, look, there's all these cybersecurity challenges and competitions and contests you can do. There's a thing called bug bounties where companies put out a reward and say, look, if you find a problem in our system, tell us, we'll give you money.
Great.
And there's a guy who became the first bug bounty millionaire. He'd made $1 million from right. So there are efforts to do that. The problem is there is a thrill, there is a buzz, again, from having talked to young, particularly young hackers, there is a buzz to getting in somewhere you're not supposed to get. I mean, you know, a lot of us have had the experience as a kid of, you know, you're finding your way into it, you know, going through the hole in the fence and finding your way into some deserted place. And there's that buzz of being in forbidden territory. And it's part of being a youngster, you know, exploring what we, you know, exploring the thrill, exploring the boundaries. So unfortunately, no matter how much of that stuff we do, we're trying to get people to the good side of tech security, there's always going to be that thrill of forbidden territory, I think.
There was always a kind of almost Robin Hood kind of thing about hackers, that they were kind of sticking it to the man, you know, but now, of course, they're sticking it to us, and that's a bit more of a problem.
Yes, yeah, indeed. They would, some of them would argue they are still sticking it to the man, in that when they, so some of the hackers have this motivation that when they hack and they leak information, what they are doing is sending a lesson to the company that they've hacked and also other companies to say, look, this is serious. You have screwed it up. You've made this data vulnerable, and we are showing, and they have this sense that unless you make it public and make a big stink and really make it inconvenient for the company involved, they're not going to learn their lesson. The problem is, as you say, it's our data that often gets leaked. And there is, I mean, there's a site which weirdly isn't the dark web, it's a clear website, an open website, where there are something like 2.5 billion people's email addresses and passwords available, and you can just buy that. You can just buy a subscription to that. So, I understand the hacker's motivation of, well, you know, let's embarrass the security, the computer industry, and get changes made. But it's, we're collateral damage. Our details, our data's collateral damage in that.
There's various ways of finding out if you yourself have been hacked. And a lot of the time, it's not necessarily us being insecure, is it? It's people who we have trusted with our data who have been insecure. And there's a website called Have I Been Pawned, which is very, very good. So that's spelt bizarrely, P-W-N-E-D, which will, if you join the website, will send you an email saying, by the way, do you know that company X has been hacked, and you are one of the people whose data has been compromised.
And but what was weird, I signed up, you're right, that site is very, very good. Troy Hunt, the guy who runs it, very, very good security researcher. I actually got one of those emails from that site, said, you know, your details have been compromised.
Yeah, likewise, yeah.
This particular company, and I don't know about you, I looked at the company and thought, I've never heard of them. And worry is, you know, I gave my data to somebody who gave it to somebody else who gave it to somebody else, and then the third person down the line got hacked. I didn't even know what my relationship with that. Did I give them my credit card? And this is the problem with this. Personal data is a really tricksy term, because we're used to a world in which things that are valued are scarce. Gold, for example. There's not a lot of gold in the world, so it's valuable.
Yeah.
Oil. There's not a lot of oil in the world. It's valuable. Data is completely the opposite. There's loads of data in the world and it's increasing all the time, which by normal economics should mean it gets cheaper. But actually, the more data you have, the more you put it together, the more valuable it becomes, which is why Twitter's valued at billions of dollars, is because Twitter's got lots of bits of data and it puts them all together to form a picture of you. And this is the problem we have when we give away personal data. Because it's not like gold or oil, because we can't see it and touch it and feel it, we don't think we're giving away something valuable. But on the other side, there's this industry pulling it all together and smooshing it together and turning it into gold. I find this, you know, it's endlessly fascinating.
Yeah. I'm just looking now on that website and seeing what companies have got the largest breaches, and I've never heard of half of them.
There's data one aggregators.
There's one here that have been breached 772,904,991 accounts were breached by this company. Extraordinary. Yeah. And of course, people are becoming more aware of it, but they're not really sure how to deal with this. You know, the public are told to be very careful when they receive emails, all the rest of it, and to use anti-spam protection and a decent security system on their computer. But at the end of the day, these people aren't stupid. They're really clever, aren't they? And they come up with some ingenious ways to get round the system.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, you know, it is depressing, though. Email is still the number one infection vector. Mm. It's sort of germ-laden sneeze in the elevator. If this is one thing people can do, just watch your inbox like a hawk. Absolutely. You know, the stuff coming through. They're getting more convincing, those emails, but it's still that case. And obviously now, you know, Facebook, social media, Instagram, that kind of stuff, you know, if you're looking at links and clicking on links on those sites, the problem is, of course, often you can only see the first bit of the link you're clicking.
Yeah.
So you don't really quite know where you're going. So those things, I think, it's definitely something to watch out for.
And you mentioned there that the coronavirus pandemic has made this a lot easier for hackers, and it has, because, I mean, I certainly got very, very fed up very quickly of people sending, you know, unsolicited videos to me, and we saw a lot of people saying online, please just stop sending this stuff because it contains malware, potentially.
It does. It's been really interesting. There's been the whole... What's interesting is there hasn't been a massive rise in traditional cybercrime. So those emails that you get, those spammy emails, there's not been a huge rise in the number of spam emails. What they've done, of course, is instead of sending you an email about an HMRC refund or a free Viagra...
Which, of course, is totally improbable in the first place. So why would you open it?
Yeah. If HMRC have got a refund about it for you, they don't email you to tell you. But they've just switched. So basically, it's now coronavirus tips. They've just switched the lure in the email to be coronavirus. But what has been really interesting is the stuff that's gone around. I'd hesitate to call it disinformation. It's more misinformation. It's just bad advice about coronavirus. You know, gargle with warm water and that will help. What I find fascinating is I understand people who send emails around saying, click here to get coronavirus advice, enter your credit card. I understand the motivation. With that bad advice stuff, it wasn't like at the end of it they were asking for your password or email address. It just seemed malicious, just you know, vindictive to send around stuff that wasn't very good. For no discernible win, they're not going to get any passwords or email addresses or credit card details out of it. I really was interested by that.
Yeah, and of course, some seem incredibly innocuous, and Facebook's particularly guilty for these kind of online quizzes that people fall for. You know, tell me, oh, what was your favourite car when you were growing up, your favourite colour and all that stuff, and they just answer this stuff, and it's basically all your security questions.
Exactly, yeah. And so what's interesting about that is I've always thought, well, you know, can they tie that stuff to your email address and so on? But the other thing is, the way hackers work is, if you're trying to answer those security questions, one option is to try and get the actual answers. Another option is to get the most common name for a pet. So if you're like, you know, what was the name of your first pet?
Yeah.
If you've got the most common pet names, which from a quiz like that you might do, you can just try and use those. So those quizzes, they're really, you know, and I mean, you don't think of that as personal data, but you're right, that is personal data. And again, we don't value it because it's just your pet's first name, but it's data about you, and we've got to start thinking of this stuff like nuggets of gold.
Absolutely. And last week I interviewed somebody about deep fakes, where videos were being made that, you know, of people saying things they never actually did, and the AI was extraordinary that was making up the voices. And I pointed out to the interviewer that I was using now bank voice recognition and thought that was a wonderful breakthrough. But of course, it isn't a wonderful breakthrough anymore because they can now impersonate your voice.
Yeah, it is. The bank security people who do that voice recognition stuff, they reckon they can spot the deep fakes, and they reckon they're onto that. However, it's then an arms race between the bank security guys trying to spot it and the voice, you know, recognition criminals, the voice synthesis criminals trying to get better and better. So yeah, but it's what worries me about that whole deep fakes thing is there was UK, in the UK, the Intelligence and Security Committee put out a report a few weeks ago into Russia, and there was an amazing quote in the report, and it said, when people start to say, you can't trust anyone, or who can you trust these days, the disinformation merchants have won. And that's absolutely true. And the problem with the deep fake stuff isn't the deep fakes. The problem is, as soon as you know deep fakes are possible and fake videos, you start to look at all videos, you know, stuff we'd put on Channel 4 News, on the BBC, and you and say, well, you know, can we trust mainstream media? How do we know this video hasn't been faked? It destroys our ability to trust anything, not just spot the fake.
And of course, finally, the talk of the moment is the American elections and whether there's already been interference in the past into those elections. And these are not people being sent over from Moscow, you know, filling out election forms, are they? A lot of this stuff is cybercrime.
Yeah, I mean, the what I find interesting is I've written about the 2016 presidential election in my book, and the story is amazing. It's a remarkable story. I feel for the kind of obvious, balls out, you know, easily spottable hacking. Yeah. That was the high tide mark. I don't think in 2020 we are going to see the kind of remarkable hacking and fake news events we saw in 2016. It's not that they're not going on. It's that they're not going to be as visible. And there's already been stuff around coronavirus where I've researched and looked into it to try and work out, is this, you know, fake news? Is this a sort of government operation? And spotting the difference between now, between a government-run operation and a sort of cynical campaign and just grassroots normal people is really difficult to do. So but again, the problem with that is, you know, there's this issue of trust. At least in 2016, we knew the election was being hacked. We knew data was being leaked. Yeah. Whereas this time, you know, there's this atmosphere of distrust.
Fascinating. Really fascinating. Lots more in the book, crime.com. Jeff White, real pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Good to speak to you. Have a good day.
All the best.